Hello and welcome to The Sector, the radio show podcast discussing the role of nonprofits, social justice, and activism. With me, your host, Ethan Plow, broadcasting, as always, right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver on your radio dial, as well as streaming live at CITR.ca, and of course, via podcast, whenever, wherever, as technology permits. You know, if you had told me back when Barack Obama first became president, you know, back for his first term, that it would become a repeat thing to see the president give a speech after a national tragedy like a shooting or a case of domestic terrorism, that would become a regular occurrence, I would have been very skeptical of that. I mean, I would have probably said, okay, I'm sure that over the course of Obama's two terms, because let's assume that he was going to have the two terms and he ended up having the two terms, that maybe we would see that twice, you know, maybe three times. A big shooting every 4 years, I guess, is a little bit hopeful, maybe a bit naive. The fact that instead we've seen Barack Obama stand in front of cameras and talk about the issues around violence and gun control, ease of access to weaponry like that, and a culture that fetishizes guns to such a degree that any kind of conversation around it usually doesn't get beyond the kind of grief platitudes and never real any action. I mean, if you had told me that this would be what, like maybe the fifth or sixth time that he's done this, I mean, I'm not sure the exact number, but if we just kind of think for a moment, there's the most recent event, obviously, at the church. So there's the event that happened in the school in Connecticut. There was the shooting of that U.S. senator, I believe. There was the incident in California. Yeah, I mean, like, and that's just scratching the surface. There's probably about three or four more that I'm blanking on right now. I don't know. There's nothing really that I can say about that other than it's just going to keep happening, I guess. You would think that at some point the public outrage and the tragic nature of these sort of things would eventually have a cumulative effect on, you know, the American psyche enough so to motivate real political change. And yet after every one of these events, you know, the NRA is out campaigning hard. The people who love guns in America are out campaigning hard. And the narrative always becomes, well, this is the exceptional case of a mentally ill person. And it's never really a question of, well, I mean, if these guns weren't freely available as they are, this never would have happened. Or the conversation becomes, well, if only the people at the church or at wherever the shooting took place had a gun, they would have been safe. As though no one has ever been injured in a crossfire between weapons. So again, I have nothing really to add to that except, you know, my own sense of disbelief that in this day and age, at this point, we are once again seeing the President of the United States of America stand in front of cameras and talk about a tragedy that was fully preventable had there been just some gun control out there. Yeah, I got nothing else to say on that. Well, let's get on with today's show. This is episode 48 of The Sector. On today's show, we have a number of interesting topics I want to discuss, including, you know what, are millennials maybe more generous than we give them credit for? Well, I mean, I give them a lot of credit because I'm a millennial myself, but this is a good follow-up to, I think, a few episodes ago when we talked about what millennials want. This is an article that was published in the Washington Post, and I tweeted about this a few days ago. Really interesting. I want to kind of talk about this a bit later. Also, on the show, this is, in fact, the last episode of The Sector to be broadcasted from the old studio of CITR. That's right. After today, later on tonight, actually, there's going to be a kind of farewell to the old CITR studio over at the Student Union Building here on UBC. Then it's going to be transferred over to the new CITR at the new Student Union Building at UBC. So that should be a very historic and very entertaining evening of programming. For me, it's going to be, well, I mean, it's bittersweet because on the one hand, it's about moving on to new and better locations and getting, you know, more access and ultimately better technology to do a show like this. But it's also kind of sad to see the end of an era of that old studio. Lots of great programming has gone on there, and I've spent many a happy time sitting in the CITR lounge planning a show, going over notes, going over interview prep, just, you know, in general, getting ready for some big event on air, or, you know, just hanging out and listening to some music and sort of soaking in the culture. So who knows what the new studio will be like in terms of that same kind of tradition. Hopefully we'll be able to build sort of a new tradition, and we'll build up its own culture over time. And, you know, maybe in 45 years or whatever, when there's another new station, we'll be able to look back and say, wow, you know, that new station, new in quotation marks, really did kind of carry on the torch. So quite wonderful stuff. Again, if you're looking forward to listening later on for the wake of the old studio that's happening tonight here on CITR, if you're local, you can stop by and say goodbye in person. And if not, you can just listen on the radio. As I said, it should be a great thing to listen to. Well, let's get on with today's show. Before we do that, we'll take a quick commercial break, and we'll return to the sector after this.
Bam!
Peanut butter and jam!
What the f*** are you doing, Phil?
Right now, it's time to...
Peanut butter. First you dig peanuts and you dig them. Then you crush them. Then you spread them. Peanut butter. Peanut butter.
We're looking for the best in local music and local food. It's got to be Peanut Butter and Jams with your host Brenda and Jordy, alternating Thursdays 6 to 7:30. Check it out.
We just played Velvet Dinosaurs and their latest hit, Eating the Plate. Now, let's go to the phones and hear what you have to say. Go ahead, caller, you're on the line.
Smash the dirty red scum! Take him in the teeth, red hats!
Really?
Kill!
That's really
kill! Bad. Kill! Filthy bastard tummies! I hate him! I hate him!
Well, Maybe you should relax a little bit. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
I swear to God, I'm not wearing just my underwear right now. This is Beth.
Hi, this is Beth Ditto from The Gossip, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver.
No, yeah, this is the best thing in the world. You guys are going to be blown away.
And we are back here on The Sector with me, your host, Ethan Clow, discussing the world of nonprofits and social justice. So I was just thinking here, you know, given the fact that it is CITR's, well, this is the last show of The Sector in the old studio of CITR, maybe I should play some music a bit later, you know, as a way to kind of, I don't know, send it off on a good note. So we'll think about that. We'll you know, touch base on that a bit later. In the meantime, I want to remind everybody, if you want to participate in the show in terms of sending us ideas or your thoughts or, you know, letting us know if you think that we've gotten something wrong and we need to be set straight. You can do so. You can email us at SeckerPodcast@gmail.com. And you can tweet us on the Twitters at Ethan Clow, all one word, or at Sector Podcast. And if you want to visit us online on our website, it's sectorpodcast.wordpress.com. And there you can find our show notes, as well as the download links for the podcast, as well as links to any of the relevant topics that we brought up, things that you can follow up on your own. Double check, you know, make sure that I'm not, you know, throwing a fastball. And in general, just kind of follow up on some more nonprofit social justice-y type stuff. But first, a question. When was the last time you went to a library here in Canada? Well, you may be in for a surprise if it's been a long time, because Canada's libraries are not what they used to be. I've been following up on some stories recently regarding the state of Canada's libraries. Some of these stories are a bit old, but nevertheless relevant in today's, you know, modern age. Not only are libraries and museums falling behind in upgrading with technology in terms of bringing online our libraries, our catalogs, and, you know, making that step into sort of digital libraries, but we're also facing some pretty serious cutbacks in terms of funding for libraries, including science libraries, which you might think is a bit of a strange topic, because a science library is not exactly the place you go to, you know, pick up a new page-turning bestseller. Nevertheless, though, they are repositories of some of the most important information that we've collected, especially on the environment, especially on, you know, Canada's wildlife, oceans, fisheries, natural resources, whatnot. And I guess not surprisingly, the federal funding for such libraries has been dwindling. And the impact that this is having is quite chaotic. As these funding cuts happen, the space and the capacity of libraries to house this information obviously goes down. So a lot of this information gets either destroyed or completely lost. In some cases, you have books and catalogs and educational material just being tossed into a dumpster. In other cases, for example, Winnipeg's Historic Freshwater Institute, its library was scavenged, or some say preserved, by citizens, scientists, and local environmental consultants, basically rescuing what was left of all this educational material. In some cases, the material wasn't quite so lucky. It was either burned or went into landfills. Now, the line from the government, of course, is that this information is being stored digitally, but the original 9 regional libraries that the Department of Fisheries and Oceans had was whittled down to 2. And as you can imagine, that's a pretty big reduction. According to several of the scientists who work for the Department of Fisheries and Oceans, this information is being lost forever. And that's pretty devastating. And if you look at the long-term effects of this, the fact that we're losing our ability to accurately even understand the environment around us, which I think should raise alarm bells for most people, but it's filtering down to our, you know, everyday city libraries, where they're losing funding, they're losing the ability to keep up to speed with technology. You know, one of the things that we've noticed is that bookstores, book retailers, Chapters, and the other big bookstores have been shutting down across the country. And they're not able to compete with Amazon and that kind of instantaneous response time that you can either, you know, order a book and have it delivered in a couple days, you know, 3-4 days, or you can download it to your Kindle and there you go, you have it. But that's also starting to affect the libraries as well, because now people are saying, well, I could go all the way to the library and, you know, rent or borrow a book. Maybe I can download it to my Kindle. I don't really know. And, oh, I don't understand how the return policy works on that. Does it get deleted after a couple of days? What, blah, 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 blah. Or I can just pay $15 and get it forever. And I'm sure that there are people who are kind of happy to have that arrangement, but it is kind of tragic when you think that libraries are a source of public knowledge. They are a source of civic pride, really. They should be. And the fact that we're letting them kind of just deteriorate is really depressing. Now, the long-term effects of this remain to be seen, but at the very least, we can certainly look at what would be the consequences for a country like Canada, where we have one of the largest coastlines in the world, if not the largest, maybe, a huge reserve of fresh water, huge reserves of lakes, rivers, and natural resources mixed in with all those lakes and rivers, as well as a very delicate ecosystem when we consider the fact that, right above us, geographically speaking, is a huge iceberg. There is, you would think, not only a moral but also a practical reason for keeping this information close at hand. And the fact that in some cases it's being lost, in some cases it's being cut back and almost hidden away, is very concerning, very shocking. Now you combine this information with other reports suggesting that Canada has completely fallen behind the world when it comes to preserving our libraries, our museums, our art galleries. In fact, digitally speaking, Canada is falling way behind in terms of making sure that our information, our backlog of data, is safely protected. So all this means is that we have boxes and boxes and boxes, warehouses full of useful information, information that could potentially make the difference between everything from getting a firm grasp of the environment to providing the right resources for people to learn and educate themselves and gain culture in cities. We have all this information that's sitting in some warehouse somewhere under stacks and stacks of books. And we don't have the resources to make these things physically available. And we don't have the resources to digitize them properly. So all this means is that we have one disaster, one fire, one internet wipe away from having our only backup destroyed. It's not very secure, and it's not very helpful for public education. well after World War II, you were still steeped in that propaganda, in that culture. You are, again, more susceptible to fall into anti-Semitism, to fall into whatever form of racism is popular there. Now, to bring this into more modern times, we certainly know that racism in Europe is alive and well. We've talked about it many times on the show, is that racism in Europe is a very complex system. It's not so much dedicated to any given particular group of people, whether it's anti-Semitism or, now more modernly, sort of anti-Muslim. It's often rooted in a different kind of cultural dressing. So, for instance, you're not so much seeing people walking through the streets saying, "We hate brown people." Rather, it's more cloaked in this notion of these Muslims who come into our country, they don't respect our values, they don't respect our laws. They want to bring their own values and their own laws into our country. And they're not part of our culture. They're sapping away the uniqueness of Europe. That kind of racial identity is one of those unique aspects to the way Europe works. And ultimately, you can look at the kind of conservative elements within Europe, and you see that narrative play out over and over again. And again, you know, we've discussed this before, not only on The Sector, but, you know, me and Don have done a number of shows in the past on Radio Free Thinker talking about the way that xenophobia evolves and changes in Europe. But what's interesting, of course, is that we can look at what's going on in America right now, the backlash against the Confederate flag. Obviously, many southern states use this flag as their state flag. Many of them have faced criticism, you know, for such a very long time that how could you possibly use a flag that was used to support slavery as your state emblem? Well, recently that's starting to change, and there's a lot of pressure. A lot of states are saying, you know what, it's time to take down this flag. And of course, you get the people who defend it, and you have to wonder, you know, why would they defend that flag? Why would they suggest that this is something that we should keep around, this cultural remnant of such a horrible time of American history? And I think this study and what we've been talking about, this indoctrination, is one of those answers. If you grew up in a culture that maintains this kind of racism, this kind of viewpoint of black people in the South, it's not really a surprise that you would carry on that tradition, whether or not you recognize that as racism. But whether or not your parents did, or your grandparents did, if you grew up, if you have relatives who grew up within a system that indoctrinated a viewpoint of black people being less than human, it's very likely that propaganda is going to perpetuate and exist for a very long period of time. I mean, look at this. You have people who identify with Nazi propaganda that was prevalent in Germany in the 1930s up to the 1940s, more than 50 years after the fall of the Third Reich, and it's still being perpetuated in Europe. It's really no surprise that that same kind of racism exists and flourishes in the American South now. And again, it's a very, very similar time frame. You look at the civil rights movement as it got started in the U.S., you know, in the 1930s and 40s, really reaching its tipping point in, you know, the 1950s and 1960s, when you started to see the Confederate flag pop up again, it wasn't a source of Southern pride. It wasn't about celebrating Southern culture. That flag wasn't even the flag of the Confederates. It was a battle flag used by General Lee. That flag became a way to showcase the fact that you were willing to support the Ku Klux Klan, that you were someone who was against the civil rights movement, that you were against the idea of black people having equal rights. It was a flag that you used to indicate your willingness to use terror on black people in the South. So, again, it's not really a surprise to anyone that the continued racism and the continued fetishization of that flag has become so ingrained in that culture and that kind of weird melting pot that is the American South. One of the kind of kickbacks against this anti-Confederate flag thing has been pointing out the controversies, I guess, that exist around other flags. So, for instance, you know, the normal American flag, the normal stars and stripes American flag, saying, well, look at all the bad things that are associated with this flag, which, you know, is not really a great argument to begin with, because, as I've said, the Confederate flag, as we know it, its history is uniquely steeped in racism. And of course, you can also look at all the bad things that have happened under the Union Jack, under the American flag, under any flag, really. But one of the, I think, standout factors, and I think this would also apply to someone who wanted to, say, fly a swastika flag, is that if you look at the founding message behind a Confederate flag or a swastika flag or whatever, what that flag stood for was, you know, terrorizing the enemy, you know, and in the swastika's case, terrorizing the enemies of the Third Reich. In the case of the Confederate flag, terrorizing the enemies of the Southern U.S., which in that case was, you know, black people, civil rights advocates, etc. If you look at those messages behind those flags, they are front and center in its history, in its foundation. And when you flew those flags at various points in history, the message you were trying to intrinsically send is that, you know, watch out, I support the values of this flag. Now, you can say, okay, well, look at all the bad things that have happened under other flags. And it's true. Yeah, they've had bad things happen. But those flags do not intrinsically necessarily mean you support those things. That they happened is one thing. Whether or not that flag is meant to represent those bad things is quite another. Now, some would say that this is an argument of splitting hairs, but I would actually suggest that the nuance and the subtlety here between, you know, having a flag that initially set out to represent something, you know, versus a flag that has, I don't know what the right correct terminology would be, flown over certain things, is quite a bit different, if you get where I'm going. Now, actually, it kind of reminds me of a weird story that I encountered a long time ago. When I was a history student here at UBC, I was taking a course on the sort of World War II time frame, sort of symbols in Nazi Germany. And there was a student there who was making the case, a very strange case in my opinion, that he would be as offended, if not more offended, by seeing somebody wearing a United States flag than wearing a Nazi flag. And, like, I think that he was making the same kind of mistake in logic that I'm talking about here. He was ignoring the fact that the Nazi flag, or a Confederate flag, and for our conversation, was created for an express purpose. It was created with expressed imagery and mentality in its intrinsic value. The flag is used for a very specific reason. A very specific message is meant to be sent by flying that flag. Versus the, you know, related travesty, related problems of a flag in general. Because you could say that the U.S. flag has represented some very bad things in history and very bad things in life. Sure it does. That same logic, of course, can be applied to any flag that has existed for any amount of time. The Union Jack, the Canadian Maple Leaf, the French flag, whatever they call it in French, the Russian flag. All of these flags have a history that you can look at and go, ooh, you know, look at that bad thing that happened under the guise of that flag. The difference, of course, being, though, is that one is intrinsically created to send that message, and one is associated with that message by nature of being the flag of the time. So that's the point I'm trying to get across with this particular conversation. Anyway, this has gone a bit long. Let's go to a quick commercial break here on The Sector. Maybe play a bit more music, and we'll be back after this.
Let's listen in as one poor soul tries to find something good to enjoy on the radio. Let's see here. God. Oh.
Everybody dance, dance. What, you don't like to dance? Everybody dance.
Oh. Everybody. God, this is awful.
Well, I climbed up the mountain, climbed back down again for you. I climbed up the mountain again for you, and then I climbed back down, climbed up.
Oh. Isn't there anything, 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 anything?
Listening to the radio these days can be distressing. Fortunately, here at CITR, our programmers choose the music that they play, so our charts reflect what people actually listen to. To find out what's really topping the charts, pick up a copy of Beatroot or Discorder magazine, or check us out online at CITR.ca. Unless, of course, you'd rather keep listening to the chart-topping single, Everybody Dance.
What, you don't like to dance? Everybody dance. Everybody dance. Everybody dance, dance. What, you don't like to dance? Everybody...
I know wrong from right. Learned a long time ago, things ain't always black and white. Just like you can't judge a book by the cover, we all got to be careful how we treat one another. Skin deep. Skin deep underneath, we all the same. Skin deep, skin deep underneath, we all the same. We all are the same. He never called me by my name. He said, boy, do this and boy, do that. But I never once complained. I knew he had a good heart, but he just didn't understand that I needed to be treated just like any other man. The same. Skin deep, skin deep, underneath, we all the same. Set my child down when he was old enough to know. I said, out there in this big wide world, you're gonna meet all kind of folks. I said, son, it all come down to just one simple rule, that you treat everybody just the way you want them to treat you. Skin deep, skin
And we are back here on The Sector, here on CITR, with me, Ethan Clow, your host, discussing the role of nonprofit, social justice, and activism. So before the break, we played a song by Buddy Guy, Skin Deep, off of his album, also called Skin Deep. Great stuff. Well, as I mentioned at the top of the show, I came across a very interesting article discussing the idea that perhaps millennials are actually more generous than anybody realizes. Now, of course, anybody in quotation marks, because I already knew this, because I'm very bright. But no. In seriousness, this actually kind of dovetails quite nicely with our previous episode, which was 46, talking about what millennials want out of, you know, their work, their life, and what they want from a nonprofit perspective on how to, you know, best transfer their altruism into donor dollars, volunteering, etc. One of the things that we talked about was this perception of millennials, because they don't give as much to charity, that they're kind of greedy, they're selfish, and that because millennials tend to want a greater work-life balance, they tend to want a lot more out of what it is that they do. They want, you know, better healthcare, they want better, more vacation time, et cetera, et cetera. They want all these things from their workplace that traditionally, you know, their parents, older generations, had to really work hard to earn. Millennials tend to want that out of the gate. And so this has led to this notion that they're kind of selfish and a bit, you know, self-absorbed. But as is the case always on this show, when you kind of look beyond the initial kind of rumor mongering, you see that millennials are actually in a very different position than their parents were. In many cases, in a very strange position in terms of financially and also where they fit in sort of the workforce of today. You know, we talked in the last time that millennials are dealing with a lot of student debt. They're dealing with a very high unemployment rate. And they're also in this bizarre sort of ether where they're kind of stuck between baby boomers who haven't retired, who hold a lot of all the positions of authority, who hold a lot of the positions of high paying and, you know, good benefits. And so there's not a great gap for millennials to enter the workforce. You either start at the very bottom, which nobody wants to do, or you are kind of stuck in this position where you're never really going to advance because there's always going to be someone ahead of you who has kind of taken that prime real estate of a job position. Now, I mean, not to rehash what we talked about last time, but when you put all these factors in a row, you see that it's not so much that millennials are jealously guarding what income they have. It's that the donor ability of millennials is vastly different from any other generation. So the fact that they're not donating as much as baby boomers, well, that's not a surprise. That shouldn't be a surprise. And we really shouldn't assume that that's because they're greedy or selfish. But what is important to point out is that millennials are in fact donating, and they are in fact getting involved in the nonprofit and charity sectors. What's interesting is that according to this study, 84% have made a charitable donation in 2014. Of those givers, only 22% said their donation was solicited through their company. 78% made their donation on their own. And this is actually a pretty big shift. A lot of people of the generation before the millennials, they would donate through their company. You would take a small subsection of your paycheck off, and that would go into some company-sanctioned charity project. Millennials aren't doing that as much. And this sort of comes back to the notion of social corporate responsibility, but also adapting that so that it's not a one-size-fits-all. And that just makes sense. I mean, it should, at least. The idea that not everybody is going to have the same buy-in or the same agreement on whether or not a cause is worthy. As we've talked about on the show many times, you can look at the ways that different generations value donating to different causes. Millennials in the workplace are going to be completely different than what, you know, a Gen Xer or a baby boomer views as important and worthy of donation to. So how you adapt your corporate social responsibility and how you're able to accommodate people who say, well, you know what, I don't really want to donate to this cause, I want to volunteer over here. If you're adaptable, if you're able to say, okay, well, let's roll with that, you're going to have a much greater buy-in overall from your millennial workers, and you're also going to see that they actually are as generous. They want to be generous in different ways and to different causes. One thing that was interesting is that the article points out that the level of volunteering that we're seeing from the millennials is very, very optimistic. It's very impressive. The fact that maybe they're not being able to match donor dollars with the older generations, but they are outpacing everybody in terms of volunteering. They want to use the skills that they have. They want to use the abilities that they've learned. They want to, you know, incorporate what their education is and what their work experiences are, and they want to take that skill set and donate it. That's a big sign of generosity. That's a big sign of involvement. Now, what's also, you know, really great about that is when you're young, and everybody who, you know, goes through this, you're idealistic, you want to do good things. And what's awesome about the millennials is that this optimism is motivating them to get involved as volunteers. It's motivating them to donate, if not the money that they have or don't have, donate their time and resources to helping causes that they are passionate about. That's incredible. That's really important. Volunteering is like a gateway drug to the nonprofit sector. You know, the more you get involved volunteering, the more likely you are to say, hey, you know what? I could see doing this for a living. I could see, you know, working for these companies, these organizations, these nonprofits. And that is such an important step in that kind of community engagement stepladder that we've talked about before. If you're able to get people in the door, even if they're not giving cash, if they're just volunteering, giving you their time, that means that they like you. And the fact is, if you play your cards right, not only could they potentially become employees, they could potentially become big-time donors down the road. So this is a really refreshing study. Not only does it show us that generosity doesn't have to come in dollar signs, which is a big point, I think, that we don't get across often enough. The nonprofit world isn't always just walking around with their hands out. They also need people to, you know, join them in their efforts to volunteer. That's a great way to give back. So again, like, really optimistic study, really fantastic that they're finding these results, and that it's also showing that generosity, again, it comes in so many different forms. And if we can nurture this, and indeed I think that we should, really, honestly, the sky's the limit. I mean, this is going to represent a major dramatic shift in how we view charity going into the future. Well, isn't that nice to end on like a happy note for once here on The Sector? I don't know if we do that often enough. I should keep like a little tally and see, like, how often do we close on me saying, well, maybe this will get better, I don't know, versus me going, wow, this is really good, this is awesome. I'm going to keep track of this. This is my new promise to you. I'm going to keep track of just how optimistic I end our shows on. And we'll, you know, hopefully we won't go into the next program all depressed and like, life is awful, But anyway, we'll see how it goes. Well, and speaking of all that stuff, it is time for the show to come to a close. This is pretty amazing. This is the last time that I'll be closing out the show from CITR's old studio, located in the Student Union Building here at UBC. I look forward to doing the same thing next week, only in the brand new studio, in the brand new Student Union Building. Very excited about this. I really just can't wait to see what great, amazing things happen in that new studio. Well, to all of you who have tuned in today on episode 48 of The Sector, thank you for joining us. This has been a fantastic journey, talking a bit about, kind of talking about the whole concept of out with the old, in with the new, but, you know, in a kind of a skeptical way. I think I figured out the title for this episode will be Out with the Old, In with the New? ? We'll see how it goes. Anyway, stay tuned here on CITR. Coming up next is Up on the Roof. Of course, we here on The Sector will be back next week, same time, same place, here on CITR. And remember to subscribe to the podcast over at sectorpodcast.wordpress.com or at citr.ca. This is Ethan Clow, your host, saying thank you for listening. See you next week.